Today on Valley Edition, parts of the Central Valley have been called food deserts, areas without grocery stores or places to buy fresh fruits and vegetables. Now a national project called the Food Commons is turning to Fresno to try out a fresh solution to the problem of hunger and healthy eating. We'll also find out how some winemakers on the Central Coast are adapting to California's drought.
I would like to have some staying power to stay in agriculture, which means it's got to be sustainable. You're going to have the economy work.
Later in the show, it's not just giant sequoias and breathtaking mountains that draw people to our national parks. It's also the amazing light show up in the sky. We'll learn more about this weekend's Dark Sky Festival at Sequoia and Kings Canyon. That and a special in-studio performance from violinist Patrick Contreras. It's all coming up on Valley Edition, right after the news from NPR.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The White House is deliberating a stunning federal appeals court ruling today that essentially invalidates subsidies for millions of low- and middle-income Americans who purchase coverage through Obamacare. A three-judge panel determined that the law only allows insurance subsidies in states that have set up their own exchanges, negating an IRS regulation that allows subsidies in all 50 states. If upheld, the decision could lead to premium increases for more than 4 million people in 36 states who purchased insurance through the federal exchange. Secretary of State John Kerry is pressing Hamas leaders who control Gaza to pursue a truce with Israel. Following a meeting with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi today, Kerry said Hamas has a fundamental choice to end a conflict that has led to the deaths of hundreds of people since Israel began its offensive following a barrage of rocket attacks from Gaza.
We have watched a humanitarian crisis in Gaza grow worse day after day, people losing their homes, all of their possessions, their access to food and water, their entire way of life.
The bodies of most of those killed when Malaysia Flight 17 was brought down are now in a city controlled by the Ukrainian government. Many of the dead are Dutch, and the Prime Minister of the Netherlands warns relatives that some of the remains may take weeks to identify. Here's the BBC's David Stern.
The relatives of many of Flight MH17's passengers will receive a measure of solace. Now these bodies are making their final journey home. International investigators are currently trying to determine the cause of the crash. Many people believe evidence is mounting, which points to an attack by an anti-aircraft missile, possibly fired by pro-Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine. However, monitors from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe say crucial pieces of the aircraft have been cut into and altered in recent days.
That's the BBC's David Stern reporting. Well, they're going to the polls today in Georgia. There are primary runoff elections in the state. Voters are choosing a Republican senatorial candidate. And as Susanna Capaluta tells us, they're also deciding whether Bob Barr returns to Congress.
Former Libertarian presidential candidate Bob Barr has been fighting a bitter runoff race against Tea Party-backed candidate Barry Laudermilk, a former state senator. Barr served in Congress for much of the 90s, where he led Republican efforts to impeach President Clinton and authored the Defense of Marriage Act. In 2008, he apologized for his role in DOMA. There is no Democratic opponent in the conservative 11th congressional district, so the winner of the primary will go to Washington. In the Republican senatorial runoff, either Congressman Jack Kingston or businessman David Perdue will face Democrat Michelle Nunn in November. For NPR News, I'm Susanna Capaluto in Atlanta.
At last check on Wall Street, Dow was up 70 points at 17,122. This is NPR News. Today, the Montana Supreme Court will publicly reprimand a judge who gave a lenient sentence to a former teacher for raping a 14-year-old student. From Montana Public Radio, Edward O'Brien reports the censure is a public declaration by the High Court that a judge is guilty of misconduct.
District Judge G. Todd Baum of Billings gave Stacey Ramble just 30 days in prison after suggesting the victim also shared responsibility for the 2007 rape. Ramble was a 47-year-old business teacher. The victim was one of his students. The girl committed suicide before the case went to trial. Baum is scheduled to appear before the Montana High Court in Helena this afternoon, where he'll be publicly reprimanded for conduct dishonoring the position and the court's judicial system. For NPR News, I'm Edward O'Brien in Missoula, Montana.
Consumer prices are still rising, though they did so at a slightly slower pace in June compared with the month before. The Labor Department is posting a 0.3% increase. The increased cost of energy was a factor, but core prices, which exclude the volatile areas of energy and food, mark only a 0.1% increase in June. U.S. home sales have increased 2.6% in June. The National Association of Realtors, says a seasonally adjusted 5 million plus existing homes went off the market, the first time that's happened since October. However, the pace of sales are still below where they were a year ago. U.S. stocks trading higher, Dow gaining 71 points. It's at 17,124. NASDAQ up 36 at 4461. S&P 500 up 11 at 1985. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, the environment, medical research, and child well-being.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens here, where we live, learn, work, and play. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
Hello and welcome to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll get a sneak preview of this week's Fresno Food Expo. We'll also learn about a new project that aims to bring healthy, fresh food to communities without grocery stores and to preserve farmland in the process. It's called the Fresno Food Commons. Later in the show, we'll have a special in-studio performance from Fresno jazz, rock, and Latin violinist Patrick Contreras. But first, as summer's heat continues, the effects of California's drought are quickly becoming severe in communities up and down the state. Last Friday, U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack came to the Tulare County community of Farmersville to announce $9.7 million in federal funding to help residents who lack one of the most basic necessities for living, running water. People like Carlin Overby.
The first thing you get stressed because when you turn your faucet on in the morning, you don't know if water's going to come out.
Her well went dry on July 4th when she was taking a shower.
We are currently hooked up to our neighbor's well, but we don't know how long theirs is going to last. We are only using their water for showers.
She and her husband live just outside Farmersville in a place called Cameron Creek Colony. About 10% of the homes there have had their wells fail too.
We knew that our well was going to go. We knew it wasn't going to last till the end of the year because of how fast the water level was dropping. But you turn it on and the water starts to trickle and then there's nothing. It starts spitting air because your pump is still working. It's still trying to pull water up, but there's nothing there. It's just air. So then you got to go out there and shut it off right away.
Vilsack says the funding will help residents like Carlin in 25 rural California communities connect their pipes to those of municipal water services.
I can't manufacture water, but I can help when you have too little of it. And I can help you use your water resources more efficiently and more effectively.
Farmersville will receive $500,000 from the USDA, or about half the cost of extending the city's water mains to Cameron Creek. The city hopes the rest of the money will come from state grants. Even then, residents like Overby will still have to pay to connect their homes to the service. Vilsack says residents face tough choices when they run out of water.
Some people might say, well, you know, if you don't have water, you know, pick up and go someplace where there is water. Well, the problem is, how do you sell your house? Who's going to buy your house if there's no water? Or if they're going to buy it, how much are they going to pay for it?
Even if the state grant comes through, it'll be some time before Carlin's pipes are connected to the Farmersville water system. It's just one story out of thousands about how the drought is having a real effect on people's lives up and down the state. Nearby on the Central Coast, communities are rationing water and are beginning to raise concerns about the effect the area's booming wine industry might be having on groundwater supplies. In this report from NPR member station KCBX, reporter Jason Lopez tells us how some Paso Robles area winemakers are looking to adapt to a new reality.
The cruel irony, of course, is that Paso Robles was named Wine Region of the Year for 2013 by Wine Enthusiast magazine, while one of the worst droughts on record raised questions about the viability of farming the grapes that are arguably the engine of Paso's success. Wine grapes are now the number one crop in terms of value in San Luis Obispo County, So it's no surprise that in places with dwindling water resources like Napomo and Paso, communities have questioned how much vineyards and the wine industry should grow.
I would like to have some staying power to stay in agriculture, which means it's got to be sustainable. You're going to have the economy work.
Dana Merrill owns Pomar Junction Winery in Templeton and sits on the board of the Paso Robles Agricultural Alliance. He says a solution to the water shortage must be shared by grape growers as well as anyone who expects water to come out of their tap at home.
Most of the studies I've seen have suggested that agriculture is really using about the same water they did maybe, you know, in the 80s, mainly because we're not watering sugar beets, we're not watering much alfalfa, and the wine grapes are pretty thrifty users.
They're pretty good at finding water in the soil.
That's Michael Costello, a professor of viticulture at Cal Poly.
That's how they evolved. They evolved in fairly dry environments, and their thing is to explore the soil profile, send their roots down really deep, and laterally, and pick up as much water as they can. So we call that mechanism drought avoidance, and that's why they were planted early on in California history, because they could actually be grown without irrigation, and that's initially how grapes were grown in California until fairly recently.
When you talk about dry farming on the Central Coast, you invariably run into this man.
People say, "What the heck is he doing this?" And I was, to be candid with you, looked a little bit as a lunatic.
It's that guy from Europe.
He's got a weird accent, and, you know, he's not even second-generation farmer. What the heck does he know? And now people ask me to give presentation on dry farming. I'm like, oh, okay.
Belgian-born Jean-Pierre Wolf began to transition old Chardonnay vines to dry farming about 16 years ago. Dry farming is a method to get vines back to their instincts of sending roots deep for water.
I don't use any water. So you can say under normal years, I save over a half a foot of irrigation water per acre.
Jean-Pierre is saving about 160,000 gallons per acre on his Chardonnay grapes. And he has aggressively cut back his irrigation of vines producing red grapes. His yield is lower, but the quality of the grapes are higher, for which he gets a better price. Growers can get bigger yields by watering more, but they are working with a plant that can live on less in extremely dry conditions. For Dana Merrill, dry farming is one of a number of things that can be done to solve the water problem.
When you look at this agricultural-based community and the folks that live here and everything else, you compare to some towns in the San Joaquin Valley or across the whole United States, and if you told folks what you're trying to maintain here and the kind of successful economy you've got here, and you ask them, is this worth trying to go to some trouble to protect and ensure, they would say, the hell yes it is. Like, we were trying to find some way. Go to Mendota or go to some of those towns over there that are just made disappear, and we've got something going on here that's pretty special, and to me it's worth some effort to see if we can't find a way to preserve our way of life and our economy.
In Edna Valley, Jason Lopez, KCBX News.
You're listening to Valley Edition. If you get far enough away from the amber glow of the San Joaquin Valley's streetlights and neon signs, like in the mountains of Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Park, you'll be treated to a whole different sort of light show, one up in the sky. That's the focus of an event taking place this weekend. It's called the Dark Sky Festival, and joining us now to tell us more about the event is Mark Tilchin. He is the executive director of the Sequoia Natural History Association. Mark, what makes the sky in Sequoia and Kings Canyon so special this time of year?
Well, actually, it's not just this time of year. It's any time of year. One of the things that people face when they live in the city is something we call light pollution, and that's light from everything from automobiles to buildings. And when you go up to a place like Sequoia National Park, you leave all that behind, and people are often amazed at what is actually up in the sky when you don't have that light pollution.
We're so used to seeing the sky from an urban perspective, and you see the stars in the city to some degree. How much of a difference is it, really, in your perspective?
Oh, it's really enormous. And again, depending on where you live, I mean, people living in the city might look up and see stars and think it's really fantastic, but it really is almost like a show. When you're out there in the dark on a clear night, it is really spectacular what you can see.
So exactly what goes on at a dark sky festival?
Good question. So it's actually more than just looking at the night sky. It's a dark sky festival, so it is celebrating the night sky or what you can see, but our events actually happen throughout the day. For example, one of the things that will be happening will be solar viewing. Of course, normally you never want to look at the sun because it could damage your eyes, but there are special telescopes that you can use, and we have a couple of astronomical societies coming, one from Riverside and one from Kern, and they will be bringing large telescopes both for looking at the sun during the day and also looking at the sky once it gets dark.
You also have some folks from NASA that are coming to the event. Tell me about the astronauts.
Yes, we're pretty excited about that. We actually have three astronauts coming. A lot of times these kind of astronomical festivals, they're lucky if they get one astronaut, and we have three. So we start with Dr. Story Musgrave, who's a retired astronaut, and he's also a motivational speaker, and he'll be speaking and appearing at Wuxachi Lodge up in Sequoia. And then we have Megan and Robert Behnken. They are current active astronauts. Both have been in space. They've been on the space shuttle. And they will be appearing Friday evening in Three Rivers and also at various locations up in the park on Saturday. And they'll be speaking, signing autographs, things like that.
What do you hope that they will bring to the event?
You know, I'm hoping that people just get excited about what is out there, in the unknown. When I grew up, at a time when people were still thinking about isn't it amazing that one day man will land on the moon? And every time there was a space flight going up, whether they were going to the moon or just going exploring, everybody was riveted to their TVs. And it seems like today it's just routine, space shuttles going up or whatever, and it's just become routine. And I'm hoping we can get that spark back, especially in the younger generation.
Now, with this event happening in Sequoia and Kings Canyon, you also have other events going on and some things like the Crystal Cave Tour. I understand there's a special one as part of this event.
I think they're going to be talking about, the darkness that occurs actually under the ground and the creatures and things that live underneath the ground. And we do cave tours go on all the time, but we're hoping to draw additional people to the cave to learn about more about what is living underneath the ground.
You were talking about kids today not having the same appreciation perhaps for space travel. Kids are glued in front of their smartphones or their iPads or things. I imagine a lot of families are your target for this event. How do you think getting out in the forest, getting out in the national parks, whether it's this event or something else beyond that, really is important today?
I think that you really can't appreciate something until you've really experienced it. And certainly you could see something on a TV or on a monitor or a screen of some sort, but it's a lot different when you are there actually participating in the event. And I think that's what going to a national park, whether it's to look at the dark sky or to look at the scenery or look at wildlife, does for you. It just gives you that sense of wonder and appreciation. And even for folks like me, and maybe who have seen many, many space flights, there's some other exciting things coming up. For example, Megan Cox will be one of our speakers. She'll be over at Grant Grove in Kings Canyon National Park for the weekend, and she is an engineer on the Mars Rover Project. So she's going to be talking about something, an area that we haven't explored yet, at least people haven't explored, but maybe someday might.
So that leads me to my next question. You have these events going on throughout both parks, throughout the whole area here in Central California. Is that correct?
The events will be actually from Lake Cahuilla, which is outside the southern entrance to the park, going down towards Visalia, and also in Sequoia National Park, and also at Grant Grove in Kings Canyon National Park. And at Lake Cahuilla, we're going to be doing water rocket demonstrations, and we'll be built, and kids will get a chance to build water rockets.
Your sister park to the north, Yosemite, has been in the news a lot lately. This in the 150th celebration of the Yosemite Grant. Sequoia and Kings Canyon are gems in their own right. I think recently the parks were named as one of the hidden gems by a national publication looking at national parks throughout the country. Sequoia and Kings Canyon sometimes maybe get a little bit overlooked in the national spotlight.
In some ways it's good. I mean, we do want people to visit because that's the way to appreciate these parks. Sequoia Kings Canyon may not have quite the capacity to handle as many people as Yosemite. The cool thing about Sequoia Kings Canyon is it's often less crowded. You can come up here even on the busiest weekend, walk 100 feet up a trail, and you don't see anybody.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Mark Tilchin. He is the executive director of the Sequoia Natural History Association about the Dark Sky Festival that starts Friday evening at Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks. Mark, if people want to go to the event or they want more information, what can they do?
We've got all the information, who the speakers are, and a full schedule on our website. It's www.sequoiahistory.org, and up at the top on the right, there's a tab that says Dark Sky, and you click on that, and you'll get all the information that you need.
Again, Mark Tilchin from the Sequoia Natural History Association joining us today. Best of luck with the event. Sounds like a lot of fun looking up at the sky.
Thank you.
And stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition and learn more about the Fresno Food Expo, which is coming this week to Central California. Also, another project called the Fresno Food Commons. It's all coming up here on Valley Edition. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Paul Betancourt, and I farm almonds, pima cotton, and wheat in Kerman. If you listen to Valley Public Radio quite a bit, you may have heard about the vehicle donation program. You donate your car, truck, or boat, and FM 89 turns it into radio programming. But hey, farmers and ranchers, have you ever thought about donating that old tractor? One call and your tractor will be picked up, and Valley Public Radio receives cash to pay for your favorite programs. Click vehicle donation at kvpr.org and donate your tractor now.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Fresno is known as a center for agriculture. It's also a center for food production and a trade show that started a few years ago and has grown quite rapidly since then, seeks to showcase the San Joaquin Valley's rich food culture and food-related businesses. Joining us now to tell us more about the Fresno Food Expo, we have Amy Fuentes of the City of Fresno and Agnes Shagapelian from Valley Lavash Baking Company, one of the companies a part of the Fresno Food Expo. Amy and Agnes, welcome to our program.
Good morning.
Hi, thank you.
Amy, I want to start with you. This is what year now for the Fresno Food Expo? This thing has grown quite rapidly in the past few years.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the fourth annual Fresno Food Expo coming up this Thursday, July 24th. So, and yeah, it has absolutely grown. Our first year, we had about 65 exhibitors. This year, we'll be expecting about 125.
Now, this is an event that does have a day where it's open to the public, but the primary focus of this isn't just to have a great party, which we all like, but it's to showcase the Valley's food-related businesses and find them buyers nationally and internationally, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So, you know, when the city started this effort, it was really an economic development effort to help bring more customers to our local food and beverage companies. And so our first year, we welcomed in 200 buyers. This year to date, we already have about 650 signed up to attend. And we have many of those that are international buyers. So they're coming in from China, Mexico, Canada, Taiwan. And so they're coming in, and it's really exposing a lot of our exhibitors to exploring their products.
What are those buyers looking for when they come to the Valley and want to see what the local businesses have to offer? What do they want to see in a company before they sign that big contract? Because this can be big opportunity for a small mom-and-pop company. And we'll talk to a Valley Lavash Baking Company in a moment, give their thoughts on that. But, Amy, what are companies and buyers looking for?
Well, I think, there's especially a lot of these international buyers. They're very, very attracted to, you know, products from the U.S. and specifically the fresh produce, but then also the dried fruit, nuts, value added. And the great thing about the buyers that we bring in through our partnership with CITD, the Center for International Trade Development, is that they're here and they're ready to buy. They're ready to start writing orders. So they're from large retail chains in China, which is, you know, meaning, again, they're ready for packaged products, products that they, you know, are shelf stable, but then also fresh produce as well.
Is that a challenge for some of the Valley businesses to be ready to take on an order that's that big, maybe on a factor of 10 times their normal magnitude or something like that, if you're just making these things in a small commercial kitchen somewhere and all of a sudden you get this big order from China and they want a million boxes of something?
Well, and that's really what we try to do throughout the year to help these companies prepare, is provide them with specific export training. And then also through the expo, there's a lot of industry connections that these companies are making within the industry. And I think Agnes can speak to that a little bit as Valley Lavage has started, you know, getting into exporting. They can talk about those industry contacts that are made. So we actually try to provide resources throughout the year that help prepare them for the show.
And I want to turn now to Agnes Shagapelian of Valley Lavage Baking Company, known worldwide for the great Lavage cracker bread that comes right out of Fresno in central San Joaquin Valley. Agnes, how has the Food Expo impacted your company?
Well, you know, it's really given us a platform to really expand the knowledge of our company and our product. As Amy mentioned, you know, with the international buyers coming in, that was an arena which we weren't involved in before until the Fresno Food Expo. So that really helped us get, you know, additional interest and additional business in the exporting that we didn't have before. So that's been really fantastic.
What do you think those big buyers are looking for, and what's that conversation like?
Well, I think they're looking for something different and unique to export into their country. I think, you know, it's a different culture. It's a different way of living. And so they're interested in introducing new products, new items, different types of things that come from our valley. And our valley has so many things to offer, from fresh produce, from packaged goods, dry goods, fruits, nuts. There's just so many options. And so I think that they are looking for companies that are willing to export and that have the capacity to export.
Now, for a company like yours that's been around, what, over 100 years now, is that about right?
We've been in business over 90, so we're almost 100.
Okay, well, giving a little advanced praise there. But for a company that's been around for, in this case, 9 decades, you have products that are very well known. You've been making them consistently for years. You have great fans. Is there a temptation to do something new, or is it just trying to refine and scale what you already do to a larger scale and grow the business while still maintaining those things that have made you good all that time? What's that process like?
Well, you know, we've always tried to stick to what we do best, and that is manufacture a wonderful lavash product. And so our base product is lavash, but we have changed the shapes and the sizes, and we do have a couple flavors. And so we're packaging our products differently as well to sell to different types of industry. So we have food service packed items, we have retail packed items, we have small individual sizes. So we stay true to our core business, but yet try to diversify in different industries by packaging our products differently.
I want to turn back now to Amy Fuentes of the City of Fresno, which helps organize the Fresno Food Expo again coming up this Thursday here in Central California. Amy, are there any trends that we should look for this year with the expo, or things that you're seeing that are happening in the food industry and maybe even locally here?
You know, one of the things, and a lot of times we actually follow, you know, buyer requests, and buyers are always looking for what's new, what's hot. That's one of the biggest, you know, that's one of the biggest things they always ask for, which is why we incorporate the new product awards. And in the new product awards, you know, we see this year in our new product awards, we're seeing a lot of value added type items. So
what does that mean? I hear that term a lot, value added.
So value added is, you know, and I can't speak, you know, extremely to it, but I can say, you know, it's when you take a product and you add something to it. So, for example, a chocolate-covered pistachio or wine-filled chocolate. So, you know, you're taking a product that otherwise comes, you know, as a raw nut, and then you're covering it with chocolate. So we're seeing more of those. You know, and we see those every year. And I think one of the assets that the Valley has is because we do have access to so much fresh product here, you know, we have a lot to work with when it comes to value add.
What are some of the success stories, in just the few minutes we have left, what are some of the success stories that you've seen companies grow and maybe make those connections in past food expos that you might be able to share with us?
Yeah, I mean, well, of course, I think a lot of people do know about the PDQ story. She launched her business at the first annual Fresno Food Expo, and as of last year, had two retail stores and is now selling to Costco. So, you know, that's when we talk about the Food Expo and what it's supposed to do, that's exactly what it's supposed to do. But then we also have companies like Dairy Goddess out of Lemoore, and she's actually a third-generation dairy farmer, and she just started doing her own artisan cheeses. And so through the Food Expo, she's also, you know, she's been able to get into a number of different local retail stores and also chain retail stores such as Whole Foods, Lassen's, Christina's Natural Market here in Fresno. You know, and then there's also Tioga Sequoia, who the first year really, I mean, was debating on whether or not to participate. And then they just met that right Save Mart buyer and now have their own huge local beer product displays at Save Mart supermarkets. And they've been coming back as a major sponsor in the past 3 years. So those are the types of successes that, you know, we really like to get from the show and that we like for our exhibitors to experience. And that's why we do it.
So obviously the big part of the show, the really, really important part of the show is the stuff that happens behind the scenes. It's those connections with the buyers and the local producers here in the Valley. But there's also the open to the public segment. Tell us about that for our listeners who are intrigued by what these companies have to offer. How can they participate in the event?
So, and that's actually the fun part of the event, right? That's the fun part that we like to talk about. So there's a public event during the evening from Thursday from 5 to 8 p.m. Public can still purchase tickets online, FresnoFoodExpo.com. For your $40 ticket, you literally get to walk in. You get to sample foods, beverages, beers, wines, chocolates, fresh produce from over 125 different Valley companies. You know, and I would like, you know, add this to speak to that a little bit from an exhibitor standpoint, because, you know, when we first started the public event, really it was for a revenue stream, you know, because this entire show is completely funded by the industry, which I think is really important for people to know. So we added the public component to really help make ends meet. But I think in our first year, a lot of the exhibitors were actually really excited about it because they said that they got to speak directly to the consumer and their customers. So I'll let Agnes speak to that as well.
Yeah, Agnes, what's that like for a business like yours?
It's fantastic. The public portion is so much fun. It's really, really busy, really crowded, and just really exciting because you get to, you know, showcase your product in front of your actual customers, and you get that direct feedback about your product from the end user, from the person who's tasting it, and you get to hear about how they use it and why they like it and maybe different ways and different ideas of using your products. And so it's just a lot of fun. It's really busy. So as an exhibitor, we always come prepared with lots of food and lots of help and really comfortable shoes because we're standing on our feet and we're talking and serving food. And it's just a great, great time. It's a great event in the evening.
Again, it's the Fresno Food Expo taking place Thursday at the Fresno Convention Center online, FresnoFoodExpo.com. We've been speaking with Agnes Shagapelian from Valley Lavash Baking Company and Amy Fuentes from the City of Fresno. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition and learn about another innovative food project going on here in the Valley, the Fresno Food Commons. It's one of the cruel ironies of life in the San Joaquin Valley, an area that grows so much of the world's fresh fruits and vegetables, is also what's often called a food desert, or at least large portions of the San Joaquin Valley. These are areas where people don't have grocery stores or farmers markets, places to buy those fresh fruits and vegetables that we grow right here in the valley. There's a lot of different strategies for addressing this issue. One group that is taking a really holistic approach to solving this problem and even problems beyond that is a group called the Food Commons. And there's a project that brings this national organization to Fresno, and it's also taking place this week. Here to tell us more is Kyle Schmidt. He is with the Fresno Food Commons. Kyle, welcome.
Thank you.
Tell me about what is the concept behind this organization, Food Commons, and what do you hope to do in Fresno?
So what you've mentioned, the issues with food access is primarily where we're doing work around, and what the model that has been developed for Food Commons takes an economic approach of how do we make local food a viable economy. So what we've what the model is built around is integrating farm practices, ownership of land under a nonprofit farmland trust, and operations within the city like neighborhood grocery stores, local food distribution to local restaurants and institutions, as well as some financing pieces to make this all have access to financing to make it happen, not just reliant on, you know, grant funding and kind of unsustainable sources.
So this is, I guess, a vertically integrated approach to trying to deal with all of these different challenges, both making it economical for farmers who are growing this food, preserving farmland, bringing access to these neighborhoods. It's encompassing all of those and also the financing of it?
Exactly. And that's what we say is that this is a vertically integrated food system. And it's a lot of how corporations nowadays will structure themselves in controlling more of their supply chain so that you can make it more economically viable. Or in the case of most corporations, it's to increase profit. In our case, it's to increase farm worker wages or decrease prices within the inner city.
So why is this necessary? What are the biggest challenges to trying to make that small organic farmer get their produce out to the community? Why isn't it happening right now? What are the obstacles?
What we've built is an incredibly efficient food system that is really good at exporting our locally grown food. So we've got a ton of production in the valley, and that's evident in the multi-billion dollars of ag business that happens in the valley. However, that system has gotten so efficient that there is not the markets locally to distribute that food, to keep it locally. If it can find better, more efficient channels, it often leaves rather than serving our own neighborhoods.
So what does your group, what's the next step? You're having a national gathering of this organization and different people who are interested in this concept. They're coming here this week to talk about these ideas. But you're actually working on this right now and working to launch this in Fresno later this year.
Yeah. So Food Commons is a national nonprofit that we have three prototypes in the work, and they're at various stages of development. Those include Fresno, Atlanta, and Auckland, New Zealand. So three very different places, but all have some interesting stories behind them. In Fresno, we've gotten some California Department of Farm, Food and Agriculture specialty crop grant funds to be working on this. We've got some other grant funding secured to purchase our first retail location this year to begin operations next year.
So you're going to have a store where people can go and buy this food that your farmers are growing on the farmland you're trying to preserve, that you have a financing arm that also helps them keep their operation going.
Correct. So we're, like any corporation, you kind of start in phases. So our first kind of modest day phase is a neighborhood grocery store. Kind of think back to the traditional corner general grocery store where you would go to get your produce daily and some other goods. So that's how we're starting, and we're scaling that in a way that it can also do some local food distribution to restaurants and small institutions. And from there, we'll be, next phase would be launching a more full food distribution system and, more neighborhood grocery stores along the way.
So where did this idea come from? How did this come together, and how did they find Fresno?
There's a really great group of folks that we've got coming that are, represent whole national food systems groups. The two founders of Food Commons are Larry Yee and Jim Cochran. Jim Cochran is the founder of Swanton Berry Farms. It's an organic berry farm on the coast that's been worker-owned and very innovative practices on the farm side of things. They put out a kind of theory document, and it was picked up locally by Edie Jessup and the Fresno Business Council, and for the last 2 years have been kind of churning on getting this idea launched locally. This year we've finally got some funding keyed in and some more local folks working on this, including myself on the development side, my experience in design revitalization. We've got Jenny Sacklar in organizational development. She's done a lot of work in environmental justice. and Dan O'Connell working on the Farmland Trust side of things.
So you're talking about setting up the store. You've got the money to purchase that, and that's in the works. Do you have farmers?
We do have some great farmers in our network that are advising in a lot of ways and hoping to kind of pass on their elder in their states, you know, T.D. Willie, Paul Buxman with T.D. and Willie Farms and Sweet Home Ranch down in Kingsburg that are advising and trying to get other farmers kind of pass on their knowledge to the younger farmers. We've got a, you know, been doing outreach to some of the more alternative, smaller young farmers in the area and getting them involved, and they're excited about ability to get their products, you know, more prominent locally.
We just have a few minutes left. I understand there's also a component of this in one of the challenges in is with food systems is whether you're talking about organic or something else is certifying it as
yeah.
organic. And you're working on something related to that, having a different sort of certification. You go to the coffee shop and they have fair trade certified beans. You're looking at something like that for Valley Produce.
Yeah, one of our key partners is Fresno Metro Ministry, and their staff member on their food systems work is Tom Matat. He is a CCOF organic field inspector, so he's got a lot of experience in organic field inspecting. We've got funding through a Wells Fargo grant to develop a certification system that will be for Food Commons use nationally. And what we're hoping for is rather than an organic certification system where there's a waiting period and you're either organic or not organic.
And you have to wait several years before.
Yeah, there's a transition period and you can brand yourself as transition organic, but there's a lot of kind of nuance.
So you aren't going to do that. You're going to do something else.
We're doing kind of a step into system where there will be kind of levels that a farmer, wherever they're at, can get into the Food Commons system and show that what their practices are. And we're concerned about environmental, pesticides, worker practices, making sure that, workers are treated fairly, paid fairly. And there's all these systems that we're, going to have a stepped system that they're, energy efficiency with buildings with the LEED U.S. Green Building Council, it's steps, silver, gold, platinum. Whatever system that we develop will likely have these phases that we can get any farmer as they come and then help them improve their practices as we go and bundle in, support and financing to help them get there. So we're increasing these local economies and getting farmers to have better practices because they want to. It's, the economy is off and the limiting factor there.
If people want more information, they're curious about either the consumer side, maybe they're a farmer, they want to know more about this system, maybe they're excited about that certification process, what can they do? Where can they go? You're having this national gathering here this week. It's not a formal launch yet, but things are going on. Do you have a website or something?
Sure. So online you can go to thefoodcommons.org. That's going to have our theory document as well as a little piece about each of our prototype locations. And then Thursday at 5 o'clock, we're having a public reception at Fresno City Hall, where Mayor Ashley Swearingen's going to be welcoming us, and all the Food Commons delegates will be here to kind of talk about the system. So that's a good place to meet some of the folks in person.
There's a lot of interesting things going on in the world of food here in the San Joaquin Valley this year.
It tastes great.
Yes, indeed. Again, we've been talking to Kyle Schmidt. He is with the Fresno Food Commons, a new nonprofit organization that is looking to take a different approach to solving the food desert problem here in the valley and also supporting sustainable agriculture and healthy eating in the valley. Kyle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment for a very, very special treat, a live in-studio performance by violinist Patrick Contreras and pianist Omar Nare. It's coming up here on Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Next.
$10,000. That's what you could win in Valley Public Radio's $10,000 drawing. Tickets are $60 with proceeds benefiting FM89. Other prizes include a Google Glass and fine artwork from a Sense of Place art gallery. Call for tickets at 800-275-0764. More information and a downloadable entry form for the $10,000 drawing are available at kvpr.org.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Being short isn't all bad. You can save money by buying clothes made for children.
Yeah, it's definitely a little rush, a little bit of glee knowing that you're kind of gaming the system a little bit. It makes up for having to use a stool to get stuff in the kitchen. It's one little victory for short people.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Short people are just the same as you.
Here and Now starts this morning at 11 on Valley Public Radio.
The San Joaquin Valley has many talented musicians, many of them also hard to pigeonhole. You could call Patrick Contreras a rock violinist. You could call him a blues violinist. You could call him a jazz violinist or a Latin violinist. Whatever you call him, he's pretty good. And he joins us here in our studio today on Valley Edition, as well as pianist and guitarist Omar Nare. Gentlemen, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Patrick is performing this Saturday at APCAL in Madera, and it's a benefit for the Ronald McDonald House of Central California. Patrick, you've been someone who you've been on the scene now in the Central Valley for what, about 8, almost 10 mm-hmm. years now?
Yeah.
What has it been like to be out there and see your music find an audience, and also as your music has changed over the years? We talked about all those different genres.
Right.
What's that process of discovery been like? Because we're going to have you play in a little bit, and our audience will get a chance to hear you. But tell me about what that's been like.
That's a great question. Well, it's interesting because I'm an instrumentalist, so I get to jump into different – I get to put on different hats. And so as I've grown in the Valley, one of the things I've really gotten interested in is the music that we have here. So I've tried to pick up a lot of the country music, a lot of the blues tradition we have here, a lot of the Latin tradition in my playing. And as far as developing – and I'm always in a constant state of rebellion. So if I start rocking too much and, like, people start requesting certain too much rock, well, then I find myself, like, hermit into, like, jazz. And then I'll just want to hang out in the jazz scene. And then when I go get too much in jazz, and now I want to just rock and let loose, and then I'll go into blues or I'll go somewhere else. And so that's really been part of my development, is that I just don't – yeah, something – Omar and I always working about this, defining an album, defining a sound. And I'm just always like, I just love to do everything and – you know, that's what.
Does that make your job really difficult trying to play with this guy because he's all over the place, a musical chameleon?
And I would say that it challenges me. It does challenge me. It just because with his instrument as a solo lead instrument, he's so versatile. And so it forces me to have to be versatile too, which is good. But I mean, I wouldn't mind. I wouldn't mind, you know, making like one full concept album with a pigeonhole sound, you know what I mean?
Yes, indeed. So, Patrick, what's your project that you're going to be performing Saturday night? Because you're doing an acoustic thing here.
Right.
Tell us about what's going on Saturday.
So, Saturday night is this plus one. So we just have a drummer that plays with us. And so the basic sound is piano, violin, drums. But it rocks. It really does. It's full. I've learned that while I enjoy the bass and electric guitar, I think the piano – when I electrify, it stands out more against a piano than it does against a guitar and a bass. So we've kind of figured out this trio, and so we've been hitting it really hard. Our drummers from the Central Coast area, we've been hitting it really hard in that area recently. So this is our first time coming to Fresno as the current group, and so I'm excited.
Oh, we're looking forward to hear something. Let's go ahead and listen to something
now.
We've got Patrick Contreras and Omar Nare here in our studio performing on a Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. And what's the number that you're going to perform to us for us today, Patrick?
Let's do Dream On. Dream On. We're going to do Dream On by Aerosmith. And we just picked this up a couple weeks ago and have been kind of working, doing something with it. So hopefully I don't butcher it too much and you guys like it out there.
The sounds of Patrick Contreras and Omar Nara here on Valley Public Radio, Valley Edition, as we heard them perform here, Dream On, and they're performing Saturday at APCAL in Madera County, just across the San Joaquin River from Fresno. Again, Saturday, it's a benefit for the Ronald McDonald House. Patrick, how did you get started in music? What was your earliest beginning? Were you in school? I mean, because you're kind of doing something that's – you're forging your own path.
Yes.
Not a lot of people do what you do.
I got started in school when I was four. My dad was an electrician, and he was fixing houses, and they couldn't – one of the families couldn't afford every – and so they offered a trade to have a violin. And so I was about 4 years old, and so I he gave me the violin, and I just stuck with it. It's something that kind of always was a part of me, and I didn't always take it seriously growing up. It was just always something that I did. My grandmother and family helped pitch in for violin lessons, and because we didn't have a lot of money, so we had to pitch in together as a family for that. And then I grew up, started playing really intensely into classical music. I mean, really intensely, but I always knew that there was something different because I always stomp my foot during practice or just feel the music physically, not just in the heart and in the soul, but physically feel it. And I knew something was different. And then I always used to love to solo on the lines. Like the first kind of troublemaker thing I did was take Carmen, the theme of Carmen, mm-hmm. and improvise my own themes off of it. I did it in college. yeah, it wasn't too. And I did it at a weird time. You're supposed to do a recital, but you know, maybe it was a bad thing, but now I recognize that what I was trying to do always was forge my own voice. And part of my training was just great. Like now I've had classical training. I've got to study some of the best music in the world. And now I get to make my own music. And I kind of relate that, not an artistic level, but kind of like Piazzolla, Astor Piazzolla for anybody who knows him. He kind of forges his own voice. And I'm not comparing myself to him, but it's kind of the same thing.
It's a great inspiration indeed. You were just in San Francisco playing at Biscuits and Blues. What was that like?
Oh, man. I'm going back, too. Biscuits and Blues is really fun. I went with Cole Fonseca, local blues artist. And then, yeah, I went with the violin. The interesting thing about playing in San Francisco anytime is that it's never just people that come to see blues. There's tourists. So there was like half the place was filled with people from Japan and Australia. And so – and China. There was a group from China that were just flipping out on the stuff I was doing, the violin. They couldn't believe it. They were like taking camera and, you know, it was something. It was neat. I never really like it's – I don't think of myself that way. I just play, you know, so it's kind of funny to see that.
That's very fun. Let's go ahead and have you guys play one more number for us. We have time for one more here on Valley Edition, Valley Public Radio. Patrick Contreras and Omar Nara in our studio. What is what are you going to play for us now?
We're going to play one of our standards that we've – I've become accustomed to playing. We're going to play at APCAL. This is called House of the Rising Sun. ¶¶
Bravo, Patrick Contreras and Omar Nari performing live in our studio on Valley Edition. You can hear them this Saturday at Apcal in Madera County, just across the San Joaquin River from Fresno. It's a benefit for Ronald McDonald House of Central California. Again, it's Saturday night. Patrick Contreras and Omar Nari, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us. Yeah, great. We'll see you guys out there Saturday.
That was a great treat indeed. That does it for today's Valley Edition. We'd like to thank Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, also our friends at KCBX Central Coast Public Radio for sharing their report on the Central Coast wine industry with us. Valley Edition audio engineer Marv Allen and production and operations manager Don Weaver. You can always send us your comments and let us know what you think online at talk@kvpr.org or send us a tweet at KVPR. For Valley Edition, I'm Joe Moore. We'll see you again next week.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.